You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Tour de France in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today we are in La Planche des Belles Filles.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Francois Thomaso.
Hi there.
Hello. Where are we, Lionel?
We're in the Vosges, at the bottom of La Planche des Belles Filles.
Can you be a bit more specific than that?
I can. We're in...
A hangar.
A hangar, some kind of farm
Champagne, I think it is, the place.
Champagne is the name of the village, in some kind of agricultural hangar. I imagine they have huge wheels of cheese in here normally, or tractors.
I know you're dribbling. Do you want to know this?
By the smell, maybe even bulls.
Bulls? Oh, wow. Oh. I mean, there was astonishment. Reaction to our last night's podcast, there was astonishment, Francois, that you have not yet uttered your catchphrase, given last night's events. We will return to last night's events in part two of this tonight's podcast. We will have more fallout from the Peter Sagan disqualification. We'll talk about today's stage in part one. Part three, we've got some astonishing journalism for you. That's all I can say.
Don't spoil it.
I'll just give you a clue. We're in an area famous for its water, and we're going to do something quite remarkable. It's never been done before in podcasting. I'm pretty confident about that.
And it will never be done again.
Never. No. Lionel, can you give us the tale of the étape, please?
I can. Stage 5 of the Tour de France, from Vittel to La Planche des Belles Filles, the first properly uphill summity finish of the Tour. Everyone was looking forward to seeing how Chris Froome, Geraint Thomas and Team Sky got on. Early in the stage, there was a big breakaway of very powerful riders. Jan Bakelants of AG2R was in there. Philippe Gilbert on his birthday, the former Belgian and world champion. Edvald Boasenhagen, Thomas Vauclair, Dylan Van Baarle and Perrichon of Fortuneo, the French team.
He was up
the road. You know, if things had panned out a bit differently, they could well have contested for the stage win, but BMC Racing for Richie Porte did an awful lot of the chasing work. As they approached the bottom of the final climb with around 20 kilometres to go, the group had only 2 minutes of their advantage left. Gilbert put in quite a strong attack with 13 kilometres to go on the kind of foothills on the way to La Planche des Belles Filles, and Bakelants got across, and it was the two Belgians who were away until the 4 kilometre to go mark, when they were finally caught by Team Sky, who looked impressive but not necessarily infallible, particularly after Kwiatkowski and Nieve did their turn. Sergio Henao kind of disappeared from view. He was there 1 minute and not the next. We were expecting fireworks, but the question was who would make some moves. Simon Yates of Orica Scott had a little go, but the man of the day was Fabio Aru, the Italian champion, who attacked very hard with 2.5 kilometres to go. There was a reaction behind, as you would expect. Chris Froome, Richie Porte, Romain Bardet and Dan Martin were the next men on the road. Geraint Thomas was going backwards. Alberto Contador was going backwards, although he did do a lot of work to try and drag a group of kind of favourites back into contention. But Aru was just too strong, and he won at La Planche des Belles Filles in an Italian national champion's jersey, just as Vincenzo Nibali did in 2014. Geraint Thomas lost the yellow jersey to his teammate Chris Froome and is now sitting second overall at 12 seconds. Aru is up to third, 14 seconds back. Daniel Martin is fourth. Then, well, it's a who's who, really, of GC contenders after that. This has been the first big shake-up of the Tour. Arnaud Démare is still in green. Fabio Aru has taken over the King of the Mountains jersey. And Simon Yates is in the white Young Riders jersey.
A reasonable sort-out. We were saying today that Geraint Thomas, who we thought might hold on to the yellow jersey, has been quite a low-key yellow jersey wearer. Not in Wales, presumably, but we've probably not given him the credit that he has deserved, holding on to that yellow jersey for a few days.
And in the same time, I think he might have kept it if Sergio Henao, who was supposed to be one of the important guys for Chris Froome in the last climb, had been up to the task. But actually, it came straight from Michał Kwiatkowski to Mikel Nieve, and the last man out to help Chris Froome in the climb was Geraint Thomas. He found himself in a role he shouldn't have found himself, and probably he paid the efforts he made in the climb, in the finale, losing a little bit of time. So to his credit, had the Team Sky plan had gone the way it should have gone, it would probably still be in yellow or not far from it.
Mikel Landa as well sort of disappeared. Yes, Sergio Henao. It was surprising to see Thomas as the last man, I guess, or not, or the only man left, still about 3 kilometres from the top. Although, you know, it's a strange climb, this one, isn't it? And the fact that it's the first proper climb in the race is sometimes... There are sometimes not strange performances, but we might see, we've seen this with Sky in the past, that they do rotate their riders a little bit. And I don't know, I don't know what we can really read into that, to be honest.
Not sure what we can read into it, but Francois, I think your reading of it is absolutely right, because Henao was there in the wheel, the camera cut away, and then when the camera came back, he had gone completely and left Nieve to do an awful lot. And that was at the point when Aru made his move as well. And so that was actually critical. And Chris Froome said in the press conference afterwards, we certainly won't leave, we certainly won't give Fabio Aru that sort of room on the climbs again, but they didn't have the manpower to do it. And quite rightly, no one else gave them a hand. It was it plays into everybody's hands if Sky have as many real credible challenges as possible for as long as possible.
Richie Port did suggest afterwards that he had thought Sky would be a bit stronger, and I think we saw in 2012 when Froome won the stage up here, and Bradley Wiggins was on his way to taking the yellow jersey. I think he took the yellow jersey here. We saw a very, very dominant performance on that day. A plan executed extremely well. Didn't see that today. No. It perhaps wasn't such a critical stage. We did see BMC take the stage on.
Well, it was. I think there's a lot of delusion in this stage, because we have now Chris Froome in the lead and Geraint Thomas in second. We have the impression that Team Sky are stronger than ever. But actually today, when Aru attacked, there was no reaction from Team Sky. And when there was reactions towards the finale, Dan Martin surged in very strong fashion in the last hill. And really, Froome looked not only isolated, but didn't look any stronger than Aru or Dan Martin. So, a very open Tour de France was predicted at the start. Well, it is probably a very open Tour de France. Well, it's open between five guys, because in the same time, let's face it, the five guys who finished top five in the stage today are almost very likely to be the man in the top five in Paris.
A bold call, Francois.
I made an even bolder call today. I was sitting with an old friend of mine watching the race, and I was seeing Aru look very good. And I don't know why, these kind of gambles we make with colleagues. I said, you know what? Fabio Aru is going to win the Tour de France. And of course, the my friend said, what the hell are you talking about? And only 3 seconds after that, Aru attacked and won. So I'll tell you what, it was not the science of the sport or my experience of the Tour. It was just sheer luck.
Well, I mean, Fabio Aru would not be a surprise winner by any stretch, would he? Because if you look at his Grand Tour record since 2014, and all the Grand Tours he's done, in 2014 he finished third in the Giro and fifth in the Vuelta. 2015 he finished second in the Giro and won the Vuelta. Last year he put all of his eggs in the Tour de France basket and went over a bit of a bump, and the eggs bounced out of that basket and smashed all over the tarmac, and he finished unlucky 13th. But that was an off day,
an off session.
It was an Earth day, an Earth 3 weeks for Aru. This year, he's the undisputed leader of Astana here, and today,
leader now, because Fuglsang lost a bit of time.
He also had a real revenge to take over the season, because he was injured, as you know, and the Giro d'Italia started in Sardinia, which doesn't happen very often. And Aru hails from Sardinia, so he was very, very keen on taking part in the Giro starting from his home island. He didn't have the chance to do that. So we can imagine that he's fresh, because very often a rider coming back from injury has the freshness that others don't. And he has this extra motivation due to the fact that he missed the Giro at home.
Just looking at the sort out, I said there's been a sort out. It's been like shuffling cards, really, hasn't it? Giving them a little shuffle, not a big sort of elaborate casino dealer's shuffle. If you've ever seen me shuffling cards, it's been a bit like that.
It was terrible racing by BMC, if you want my opinion. Terrible. I mean, they worked all day for what? You know, in the final climb, Richie Pont was on his own. All the guys had wasted their energy for chasing behind what? You know, I really don't understand what they did. I mean, they worked as a launch pad for Team Sky, and I don't want to see any link between that. But this morning when I got to the Village Départ, I accidentally bumped into two guys, isolated outside of the compound, and it was Dave Brailsford and Richie Porte. And so deep in conversation. I came close and just wanted to say hi. You know, I'm a polite person. When I see two people I know, I just walk forward and try to shake hands, and Dave Brailsford just shrugged me away like they're telling me we're into a private conversation. I said I just came to say hi, but obviously they were not
secretly recorded that, Francois. We can hear that now.
Oh, if only. Are you alleging that maybe Dave Brailsford was just instructing Richie Porte to get his team to do all of the work all day?
Of course not. But that in the past already there had been rumors or impressions in certain races that Richie Porte was still racing to Team Sky, and BMC have had this strange habit of paving the way for others to take the laurels. You know, it's very strange. I really can't understand what he did today.
I don't think anybody can really understand it. People were searching for reasons. I think Jonathan Vorta suggested it might have been a kind of vote of confidence in Richie Porte, the team showing that they really believed in him.
I think, but they should have waited for the last climb to do that.
And in doing so, they wasted a lot of energy and used up a lot of strength on Porte and Froome. Of course, they had the apparent disagreement at the Dauphiné a few weeks ago when Froome certainly did Porte no favours at all when Porte was in the yellow jersey, and there was some fighting talk afterwards from Richie Porte. I gather that a week and a half ago, the last long ride that Chris Froome did before the Tour, 6-hour ride, he did with Richie Porte. It was the first time they'd really spoken about it, and they spent 6 hours together and had a good conversation, apparently. Don't know what they talked about, but I've mentioned before, and I think I mentioned in our event, Dusseldorf, that my impression is that Richie Porte, he's in the shape of his life. It's perhaps his best ever chance to try and win the Tour, but I think he'd be very happy with the podium.
I'm afraid so, once again. You know, the limits sometimes to some guys' ambitions. I mean, Richie Porte has the talent, he has the motivation, he has the form, he has everything. It just lacked this little bit of grinta, as the Spanish say, that maybe Aru has, that Geraint Thomas certainly doesn't have. And it's a pity, because I think one day, given the good conditions, Richie Porte is really Grand Tour material. He has the potential to win one. Maybe there's a little bit missing. Well, we'll see. We have a long way to go. But, it's I don't know, confidence, fierceness. I mean, there's a little bit something missing from Richie, and it's too bad.
But just on the shake-up, it's a small shake-up. There's still only 54 seconds separating Nairo Quintana in ninth and Chris Froome in the yellow jersey. And, there's a tough stage on Saturday and then a really tough stage on Sunday. But, it's certainly not over. And when you look back at the last four or five Tours de France, when Froome's taken the yellow jersey and held it from stage 8 last year, from stage 7 the year before, Nibali won here on stage 10 and held it all the way to the finish. Froome won at Aix-Trois-du-Maine in 2013 and held it all the way to the finish. Wiggins won here in 2012, held it all the way to the finish.
He didn't win here, Wiggins. He was
Wiggins took the jersey.
I think he was third, wasn't he? Cadel Evans was second, maybe on the stage.
Can't remember. I was referring to him taking the jersey here and then holding it all the way to the finish. My impression is that may not happen here. Well, I certainly hope not. I hope there's a bit of toing and froing, but we shall see.
Hi, I'm Pera, RCC coordinator for the Mallorca chapter, and you are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to our main sponsor, RAFA. Very grateful to them, of course. And a reminder that throughout the Tour de France, throughout July, RAFA Rising is celebrating climbing with ride challenges, prize competitions and events at its clubhouse. Is the Cycling Podcast listeners are being offered by RAFA the chance to win £1,500 worth of cycling kit, go to rafa.cc/TCPwin. That's rafa.cc/TCPwin. You will be asked a question there. Which two riders have a monument dedicated to their achievements at the top of the Col d'Izoard? Is it Marco Pantani and Lance Armstrong, Louise Mbobe and Fausto Coppi, or Eddie Merckx and Gino Bartoli? The competition closes on the 23rd of July. Go to the website to answer that question for cycling podcast listeners and stand a chance of winning all that kit. Now, Peter Sagan is no longer on the Tour de France. He is quite, in the end, graciously departed. You know, gave a statement outside his hotel that he doesn't agree with but respects the official's decision. And I think, you know, we obviously talked about it a lot last night on the podcast, having watched the footage a little bit. I think all of us watched the footage again. The one mystery is, because I've not seen really good footage of the crash about a kilometre and a half to go, which Sagan is also being held responsible for. But the one on the finishing straight, which I think is the one, it's not clear, but there's some vagueness about this, but I think that is the one that he was definitely sent home for, disqualified for. That's very inconclusive to me. And when, you know, that there are various stills where it looks like Cavendish hit him first, where Sagan looks like he's off balance and his elbow's gone up along with his leg, which suggests it's balancing himself. They're both going for the same gap. He's slightly ahead. Very, very difficult, I think, to say that there was any intent on Sagan's part. But we, this morning, spoke to a number of people, riders and directors, what they thought of the incident itself and the decision to disqualify Peter Sagan. So we'll hear from them now, shall we? And the first one, sure. I think, is Ralf Denk.
Yeah, Ralf Denk, the Bora Hansgrohe general manager. As you'd imagine, pretty unhappy with the decision to send the world champion and their team leader home.
I know some similar cases in motorsport, and it's always the commissaires and the drivers on the table, and then they fall together a decision. But in this case, our sport directors, Enrico Pochke and Pachivilla, was called by the commissaires, and they submitted him just the result. The result was Peter is not more in the race. This was not discussion together. We try to open a discussion, but they say the result is already done. It's not just a rider, it's Peter Sagan, the currently world champion. They have to leave the Tour de France. They damaged not just our sporting values, they damaged also the values of our sponsors. This is a really, really hard case for us. And I'm really happy. I had this morning and yesterday evening some communications with our sponsors, and they support us as well. They have the same standpoint as us, and it's nice to have so strong partners in the background. If we don't get a reaction from the UCI, then we have to accept. We have to accept, but because we have no chance to put him on the start line without any agreement from the UCI, and we would like to respect this. But what's come then, we have to figure out together with our sponsors.
Ben Swift is a rider with UAE Team Emirates.
It is a difficult one, I think. And they both went for the same gap. I don't think anything was intentional. I think the actual, looking at it again and again, I think the disqualification was actually quite harsh. So I also think the move by Demar on Bahani was also quite extreme. You know, he went, there's photos of him on the barrier, and then he finished inside the 100 metres. He was straight away over to the other side of the road, so that was also quite a dangerous move. But now I'm really sorry for Cav, that is obviously another damaged shoulder again. It's sad to see him leave. It's also sad to see Sagan leave, because I don't think it was intentional. I think also different videos and different pictures can make it look like a different thing. So at the moment, the jury wanted to like make an example, because to be honest, there's been a few complaints about Sagan in the past. Also, you got to look at Gent Wevelgem, so he's not got a reputation, but I think the best way to nip that in the bud is maybe do something like this sometimes, you know.
Brian Holm is sports director with Quickstep Floors.
I think it was a very hard decision, to be honest. Peter Fair also. It's hard to say when you're going to say stopped. I mean, they said the jury said from the start they're going to be hard, make hard decisions, and so they did. I thought it was the whole elbow thing. That little swing with the elbow was probably just the limit. I work with a lot of commissaires, but the best one I ever worked with in cycling was actually the chief commissaire here, Philippe Marianne, and then I really like him. So for sure he made the top decision. He knew people wouldn't love it, but he made it, and well, that's life.
And lastly, Mark Cavendish, you know him so well, you know his brilliance is going through gaps that don't seem to be there. Do you think maybe he was pushing his luck trying to go through the inside there when everyone was moving across?
He's a sprinter. He tried to. We never know. Maybe he would have won the stage. Maybe he would have crashed anyway. We just never know. I mean, that's the thing. I feel sorry for everybody. I feel sorry, for Bora, the whole team losing Sagan. That's a pity. But the guy I feel most sorry for is, of course, Cav. I'm quite sure he would have won a stage here. I mean, I know he'd been sick, but I'm so sure he was ready. I mean, he wouldn't come to start here without being ready. I know him quite well. So he would have won a stage here. So, and for the whole Dimension team, is of course, a disaster. And so it is for Bora. And for sure, if I would have been sports director with Bora, I would have been pretty upset also. That's life.
Geraint Thomas of Team Sky was the race leader this morning.
The jury are the jury, and for that reason, and they make the call. So I don't know about a bad precedent. You know, if anything, it should make the sprints a bit more cleaner, you know, more straight lines and stuff. But by taking that hard line, they have to keep taking it now, you know. So if anything does happen later on, then they need to take the same approach.
Tom Steels is a sports director with Quickstep Floors.
It's, of course, it's the Tour de France. In the Tour de France, everything is a little bit bigger than in any other race. I mean, on the level of sprints, I think even Kev, when he saw the gap, he went for it. I probably would have done the same in a situation. The gap closed, then there was the tree, so you don't really see a clear view of it. Especially the movement of the elbow, I think that made the decision to put him out of the Tour. Mm. You always have to be careful, because the Tour is an example for many riders. And some things you cannot let... They don't do it, nothing in the Tour here, I think then other races will be difficult to judge anymore. It's something that happens. It's a pity for cycling. I mean, Peter Sagan is one of the biggest stars we have, but it's also a brave decision from the jury also.
He's such a great bike handler, Peter Sagan, and he can go through gaps that maybe other people can't go through. Does that sometimes create dangers for other riders?
What for him is still easy is for other guys still is already a big risk, so he can handle his bike so good. We have the same in the team with Alaphilippe. He can handle his bike 10 times better than somebody else. If you ride behind those guys in a TT, you think they're going to crash every corner, but they don't, so the feeling is different. They're sometimes a little bit bolder. So
Luke Rowe rides for Team Sky.
Yeah, maybe a disqualification from the stage would have been enough to throw him out of the whole race. It's potentially a little bit harsh. You know, I've seen things worse and people not get sent home, so maybe a little bit harsh to send him home. Just disqualification from the stage alone would have been enough.
So we heard there from a range of voices, some interesting views. I was particularly interested in what Ben Swift said about a view that within the peloton that perhaps, and I heard this in secondhand from Mark Renshaw as well, that there's a view that Peter Sagan can ride quite dangerously at times, put other people at danger. I think a lot of that comes from just his incredible skill as a bike rider, that he goes through gaps and does things that other people just aren't capable of. And that Ben Swift suggested that the very severe punishment was almost a sort of warning to calm down. He compared it to Nasser Bahani, who certainly had a reputation as a very dangerous rider. Less so now. He does seem to have...
Matured a
little bit, but you know, he
perhaps
was
as a result of that.
Well,
warning,
that's the point Swift was making. Yeah,
but the thing about this is, it will rumble on and on. But my view now is the decision is made. Peter Sagan's no longer in the race. Obviously, Mark Cavendish is no longer in the race. That does the absence of those two guys with so many sprints to come does rob the race of a little bit of its intrigue and drama. It opens the way up, of course, for Marcel Kittel, Andre Greipel, Nasser Bouhanni, Arnaud Démare, and all the other sprinters. But really, you know, we could go on and on and on. We could look at that footage and look at those photos and come up with supporting evidence for both points of view. The bottom line is that the head of the commissaires, the head of the jury, made the decision. It was a tough decision. They made it, and now the Tour rolls on, and that's how it goes.
Beware of the way we react in the age of social media, because when, shortly after the stage, everybody on Twitter and on the other social media were saying, oh, this is a disgrace, Peter Sagan should be disqualified. And some guys even, you know, overturned their first impression. Short after the first suspension, you know, the opinions had shifted a little bit. And once Peter Sagan was kicked out of the race, the villain was no longer Peter Sagan, it was Philippe Marin, the head of the jury. So within 2 hours, everybody changed their minds, and by this morning, everybody agreed more or less that, you know, okay, Peter Sagan had done something wrong. he should have been punished, but the exclusion was too tough. So maybe we should every time take a little bit of time, not comment in the heat of action, and wait a little bit, and that's what a race jury is made for.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science of Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. I think today they launched two new flavours in their Whey 20 proteiny snack, like a yoghurt thing. Chocolate orange flavour and a caramel flavour. We actually have some boxes of these to give away to some lucky listeners. And today I came up with a competition. The competition is this. Francois was telling us about a Tour de France possibly in the early 90s, where he was in a car, a press car. In those days, you were allowed to overtake the peloton. They misjudged it a little bit and ended up overtaking the peloton on the finishing straight, for which you were thrown off the race.
Absolutely,
I believe.
Right, yes. Yeah, we waited a little bit too late to make our move.
You did a Sagan. Did a Mark Cavendish, went for a gap that wasn't there. You cannot remember the year or the place. So the challenge we are setting our listeners is there will be footage of this on YouTube somewhere. If you can find a still of you, you can find this footage and take a still of it.
I can give a slight indication. It's probably between 1987 and 1992.
And the car was, what kind of car do you think it was?
It was a dark car.
A dark car. If anybody can find footage of this, we'll send you some of these wonderful Science and Sport products as a prize. Please just email us, contact us, thecyclingpodcast.com, Twitter or Facebook. Where Science and Sport are in conjunction with us are doing a Tour de France competition as well. Look out for our newsletter for details of that. Sign up to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com. Before we go on to this incredible thing that we're about to do, let's give a little plug to Kilometre Zero. Our latest one went out today. It was called the Green Tour, a little look at the various environmental initiatives the Tour is doing to make sure it leaves us as little mess and footprint, I suppose, as it can. One of the things to talk about in there was the controversy a few years ago when the Tour went up the Col de Sarenne, threat to the local wildlife, including the stoats. My brother actually messaged me to say that I should have told his stoat joke in the episode.
Which is?
What's the difference between a stoat and a weasel?
I don't know.
One's weaselly identified, the other's totally different.
Oh, very good. I mean, the tumbleweed will be blowing through in a minute.
What's the difference between a good joke and a bad joke? Timing.
Oh, this is nonsense. It's been the first big stage of the Tour de France, and we're. But let's go from the sublime to the ridiculous. This does at least have a Tour de France theme to it. We finished in Vittel yesterday. The stage start was in Vittel this morning. Of course, famous for its mineral water. Vittel is celebrating the 10th anniversary as the official mineral water of the Tour de France. They have vehicles in the publicity caravan spraying everyone with water, handing out water bottles. We drink an awful lot of Vittel in the press room, particularly when it's warm. I think they put us in the warmest buildings possible, so we drink so much of their lovely water. But last night we were staying just down the road, around 5 kilometres away, at Contrexeville, which is famous for its water also. And I asked Francois whether there had ever been a big rivalry between the water producers, and apparently in the past there would have been, because these two communities with their water trying to dominate the water market. They're both now owned by Nestle, Vittel and Contrex Water. So, but you were saying this morning in the car that you reckoned you could pick out Contrex in a lineup.
Yeah, Contrex is kind of different from the others. And last night, actually, you know, I'm from Marseille, and our national drink is pastis, and we put water in pastis. And as I say in Marseille, it was confirmed last night by the waiter in Contrex that you don't put Contrex water in pastis because it's so tasty that it ruins the pastis. So normally, I have four glasses of water in front of me. I suppose one is Evian, one is Vittel, the other one is Volvic, and another one is Contrex. And the mission I've been offered is to determine, well, if I can, you know, the Grand Slam would be to detect.
Get them all, but you've got to try and pick out the Contrex.
Completely blind.
But
here.
The major challenge is to single out the Contrex knowing but that my only contract experience is in pastis, so to do it without pastis is another challenge, but I'm sure I can do it.
Well, you're getting your excuses in early. This is the first ever edition of the Cycling Podcast Water Feature.
I'm photographing
that was
this.
That was Rich's suggestion for a
feature.
Title.
The Water Feature. Feature.
If it goes well, this could be a daily thing, guys. Come on.
Well, in Rue Saint-Georges, hopefully in Rue Saint-Georges we'll taste wine, but we'll see.
Okay. Good radio? I'm not sure.
Well, we'll find out. We'll find out later, won't we? So glass number one, please. We're going to have to hurry you along here, Francois. You haven't got time to swill it round or sniff it. You've just got to taste. Take a big gulp there of glass number one. Is that Contrex? No, shaking his head. Okay, glass number two. God, he's doing this with the verve of a seasoned wine taster.
Okay.
Glass number three.
That's Contrex.
Oh, he's gone straight for it. And glass number four.
Right, that's Vittel. Evian, Volvic, Contrex.
Absolutely, that's 100%. Extraordinary.
100%.
I'm absolutely. Wow. I was so looking forward to that being wrong.
We must promise everybody here. I didn't cheat.
No, that was absolutely 100%. He didn't even. It's a mere sip of each one. We even gave you a little bit of beer beforehand to
just to ruin your palate.
Yeah, well, no, it's just just to water my mouth a little bit. Beer was necessary. Well, maybe there's a profession ahead of me.
Water tasting.
That's amazing.
Before we move on from Vittel, of course, just another little anecdote about Vittel. It hosted the start of the 1968 tour, which, of course, was the year after Tom Simpson died on Mont Ventoux. We'll have an episode of Kilometre Zero next week about Tom Simpson and Mont Ventoux, talking to a couple of authors who've recently released books on one on Tom Simpson, one on the mountain itself. But Vittel hosted the start. It wasn't called the Grand Depart in those days, was it? This is a new invention, this term, the Grand Depart. But Vittel hosted the start of the tour because the race was billed as the Tour de Santé, the Tour of Health, after the allegations that Tom Simpson had amphetamines in his bloodstream when he died on Mont Ventoux. And the Tour wanted to associate themselves with health and vitality and cleanliness, and so Vittel was the obvious starting place. And so that's, I guess, the Tour had been held there before, but that's a strong
that's
link between the town and the race.
Has remained so clean and pure to this day.
Absolutely.
Thanks to that relaunch in 1968. Yeah. Anyway, any other business tonight? We've got more Kilometre Zeros coming your way tomorrow. We've got the Breakaway Kings. That's a special one on Wanty Group Gobert. Interviews with some of their riders, one of whom is particularly interesting. The one of the only Wanty Group Gobert riders who's not actually featured in a breakaway yet.
I don't know when you're going to hear this, but this morning I recorded documents of extremely importance in the history of music and the history of cycling. We have Jean-François Bernard singing a 1988 hit called Le Tour de France, and he even sang the chorus of it, so you will have the chance to listen to that someday on the Cycling Podcast.
Of course, Jean-François Bernard was the next big hope, the next Bernardino, wasn't he? He was supposed to inherit the crown of the Tour de France. He had the yellow jersey for a day in 1987, came to grief in the Alps.
He was ambushed.
He was ambushed, yeah.
I think they attacked him through the feed zone. He punctured, yes. And then they attacked him through the feed zone, Stephen Roach and Pedro Delgado.
And finished third, yeah.
He finished third, and then he was a favourite again in 88, but it went terribly for him. I'm going to blame that on the non-hit record.
Absolutely, because during that Tour de France, he was forced to go to Top of the Pops in the evening of the stage to sing this wonderful piece of music that, you know, you will hear it soon on the Cycling Podcast.
I wonder what our listeners would, what songs our listeners would attribute to riders if they had to go and sing on the French equivalent of Top of the Pops. I mean, Top of the Pops doesn't even have an English equivalent now. What are we doing here? People don't listen to music on television anymore. Before we go, let's just have a quick, rundown of, who did well, who did less well, because we've not talked about some pretty big name riders that have moved themselves up the pecking order, not least Daniel Martin, who was terrific today. That climb really seemed to suit him, and he was talking before the tour in a number of interviews I read about how he wanted the race to be aggressive, how he finds the kind of the stifling tactics of the tour frustrating. Today he got himself out of his box and he really was true to his words, really.
Absolutely. Fabio Aru said in the press conference that he likes to to be in the shadow a little bit, not you know, not to be too you know, upstage. And well, he you know, he went out of the shadow today, obviously. And Dan Martin is a little bit of the same. He's the rider you keep forgetting to mention when he's, you know, third, fourth. But now with what he did in Longwy the other day, finishing third, and what he did today, he can't hide himself anymore. He's probably in the condition of his life and probably riding his best tour so far. So, yes, for sure, Dan Martin is...
He's going extremely well. Yeah. I was surprised to see Nairo Quintana tail off a little bit. Quintana, I'm sure, will get better as the race hits the longer mountains, as we know, is better altitude, and when the mountains are much longer than today. This was quite a short, steep effort, not really his terrain. Contador, I think, just confirmation that he's perhaps not the Contador of old. I still expect him to do something in this race.
But look good in flashes, but those flashes are getting shorter, aren't they? There's not the same.
Shorter and further apart.
Yeah, unfortunately. On Quintana, though, he's come through a very tough Giro d'Italia. Of the riders here who also rode the Giro, I mean, he's the only one who was having any pretensions to the overall classification here anyway. But people might be catching up with the tour, wondering why Thibaut Pinot was off the back early, why Bauke Mollema was off the back early. These guys are not here for the GC this time. They're tired possibly from the Giro, and they will go hunting stages, I imagine, later on.
I think, well, that's what, you know, Pierre Rolland said to me yesterday, as we said already. Thibaut Pinot said the same apparently this morning to a couple of colleagues. All these riders obviously want to, you know, lose as much time as possible to have a margin of maneuver in other stages to go and win a set. Where is Rafał Majka? I was expecting him.
Yeah, he was up there in 12th. I mean, decent. Esteban Chavez lost almost 2 minutes. Yeah, I think.
But coming off a long, period of recovery. Yeah. But Simon Yates going very well for Orica Scott. Mm-hmm. Roman Bardet, I think, looks great. And again, this is not one for him today. No. Too short, too much variation in gradient. He could well be somebody to watch on Sunday, where they go over the top and then plummet down into Chambéry. So I think he's a real live threat here.
Simon Yates is interesting because, the Yates brothers, they keep trying to tell how different they are, and they keep following the same patterns all the time. You know, we lost Adam Yates in the white jersey, and now we have Simon in the white jersey. I mean, it seems to be
one for the other. Yeah. Well, listen, guys, I mean, I really want to get stuck into this water. I mean, we've got a hell of a night ahead of us with all this water, because Francois has only merely sipped it.
Absolutely staggered by that. Wait, I mean,
amazing. Yeah, I mean, that's the most impressive thing I've seen on this Tour de France so far.
It can only get better, though.
Okay, well, that's all for tonight.
We'll see you in Francois. 2 days' time for
Francois,
a wine tasting.
Because Francois, you're on strike tomorrow.
Yes, I won't be with you during the stage, but I should normally be freed by my other employer to do the podcast.
You're covering because of French laws. Mean that people can only work 6 days in a row, is that right?
Yes, that's right. So I have other colleagues who are forced to take a day off, and so I'm replacing them for a day.
Well, maybe we'll get Ciro Scognamiglio on tomorrow to talk about Fabio Aru, because he'll now be Fabio Aru's shadow tomorrow at the start, I imagine. He'll be picking up everything that's going on with the Italian champion. So we'll try
it's
and track down Ciro.
Great. Well, thank you very much for tonight. Thank you, Francois.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.